accession number 4588, reel 4.
Introduce the tape again. Mrs. Birkhill, tape 4. Could you continue about the story of the guarantee?
Yes. Now, the guarantee, you see, I, of course, wanted to bring in as many children as possible on a guarantee, because there was no limit how many you could bring in on guarantees. And I went around the working class district of Cambridge and knocked at doors. And all the people were terribly nice. But of course, their children went to work at 14. How could they keep a child till 18? Their social life was in their chapel or church. How could they leave the Jewish child at home when all of them went to the bun feast in the chapel? And so, in a way, you see, the guarantees of the movement were more or less middle class, excepting where you had Jewish communities guaranteeing. There was a Cricklewood fund who guaranteed a lot of children, whom we got when the evacuation came. There was the Youth Aliyah, which was of a large Jewish fund, where they wanted to train the young in agriculture to be useful when they went to Palestine, to Israel. So you got, and the interesting part is, I have the statistics, is that the guaranteed children, privately guaranteed children, as they mainly were in this sort of region, were all guaranteed by middle class people, and all were sent to grammar schools and stayed at school till 18. Now the children of the large Jewish communities went into agriculture, went to school till 14, and then went into agricultural camps. Some of them were very happy. They all wanted to go ultimately to Israel and go into a kibbutz, and they felt that this was the correct training. But others were very unhappy about this, because they obviously realized they wanted to widen their abilities and so on. And it ultimately got through that Region 4 was always interested in education. And so you got people, young boys and girls, slipping into the Cambridge region, where they knew, even though in the war they all had to do some work of national importance, they would be given every opportunity to get their matriculation and their higher school certificate, and that I would do my utmost to see that if they were able to have a university education. But it was a sort of whisper campaign, which was fantastically interesting, the way they turned up. And usually the other committee said, well, of course, if you want the thorough nuisance, you have him. We are not keen to keep him. And of course, they are now, of course, professors and men of great learning.
Could I ask you about the people in the working class, you know, these kindly people you mentioned earlier on who took the children? They didn't guarantee them.
No, they were evacuees and refugees. You see, the point is, what was very interesting and extremely sensible of the movement is, as soon as a child arrived in Great Britain, they registered that child, if under 14, in a school, whether it was holiday or term time. Because they realized that if war broke out, the children would be high and dry, whilst if they are registered at a school, even though they'd never been to the school. They would be evacuated with their school. We, of course, in Cambridge, when the evacuation started, I mean, we were living a perfectly calm, hard-working life up to then. But when the evacuation started, the system was that people were evacuated from their nearest railway station. Now, of course, the nearest railway station to Whitechapel is Liverpool Street. And the nearest railway station for Hampstead and rather the Jewish middle class is King's Cross. So we were overpowered with a Jewish immigration to East Anglia.
That's interesting.
And it was really, it was very interesting because we were very overpowered, because from one day to the other, from having about 70 to 80 children, I had 800. And Sybil Hutton felt she ought to do, what was it called, or to go into one of the,
To volunteer for the ATS or something, was it?
It wasn't ATS, no, it was the aircraft thing.
Oh, yes, I know what you mean, the women's, the WAFs, yes.
No, she wasn't, I mean, she was my age, in fact, she's older than me, she's still kicking.
But one of the voluntary women's, yes.
And so I was left alone with my, oh, it's all right, I'm pretty good at things, with this large mass. And of course, the whole refugee committee was overwhelmed. And one got extraordinary cases of English-born Jews who were so unhinged with this sudden movement from their surroundings that they would talk nothing but Yiddish and pretended they couldn't understand English. So the police used to bring them to the refugee committee, and none of us understood Yiddish. We had to find a refugee who could, and it was purely, I mean, we had a rabbi's wife who would talk nothing but Yiddish. But it was a terrible problem. I went around East Anglia with Dr. Lowy, who was the reader of rabbinics in this university, trying to help to sort out all, not only children, the whole crowd of them. And it was really absolutely heartbreaking to see how lost these people were in a surrounding they had never dreamt from. We had Bernardo's home evacuated to a large country house in Pampersford. Again, we had some children in Bernardo's home. Bernardo's home would only take Christian children. But we had three Christian children there, who were, of course, from very good homes and quite different to the other children. And the staff rather made a fuss of them, and so the other children took it out of them. You know, there was a great deal of emotional difficulties, and we got people in Cambridge to invite these refugee children out, and they, see, we did try to visit all our children. But the really extraordinary thing is that Ely, who had never known the face of a Jew, was very much an evacuation center, and the Jewish free school for boys, the Jewish free school for girls, and the Jewish secondary school for girls were all evacuated to Ely. and the what's the receiving officer called? The billeting officer was the wife of the vicar of Ely, who was a very intelligent and sensible woman. And of course, there were of course a lot of other refugees, but I mean, that was the crown of it. And of course, the children out of the Jewish refugee, the Jewish free school, a lot of those children were also refugees, besides evacuees. And they came mainly from very orthodox orphanages in Czechoslovakia, and of course had never met anything but Jews. And they wouldn't drink the milk, and they wouldn't do this, and they wouldn't do that. And it was really a heartbreaking job. But the vicar's wife simply took a very large, big house which belonged to a friend of hers and stood empty, and put a whole Jewish free school in there. The Jewish free school for girls worked very well because the headmistress was very sensible. She said, well, it's wartime, and we can't really expect the children to keep the laws. We can keep the laws, and the children should eat anything that's put before them. And so there was complete friendship and love between the Jewish girls and their teachers and the hostesses, but there was endless quarrel with the others. And of course, having to find Orthodox cooks and Orthodox kosher cooks. And my secretary and I used to go there about once in a fortnight or 3 weeks, and we were known as the white one and the black one, she being very fair, and we used to lift the lids in the kitchen to see when things were clean, and we weren't liked at all. And we did have a very great deal of trouble with that school. But the Jewish grammar school, secondary school for girls, was all right. But Ely was a real cost to bear. And of course, the poor people in Ely had never met an onslaught of Jews. But luckily, it was near enough for us to be able to interfere frequently.
It strikes me, Mrs. Burkhill, that did you have any time left for your family? You must have been so busy at this time.
No, of course, what my husband used to say, well, I think it's very good that you are so busy. You can't spoil your children.
How did you manage to do all this?
Well, because I had good servants. And, I mean, the only trouble started in 42 when my last servant wanted to do war work and left me. But then the children were already reasonably sensible, and they were so pleased not to be bossed about by servants that they all put their hands to the wheel, and it worked very well. Well, I mean, I always came home for lunch, you see. I mean, if I was late for lunch, my servant knew she had to start the lunch. I mean, we all worked in together very well. And of course, the children were... Guy was at the prep school, and the children were at the purse, and they were all very academic sort of children, and they had their horses, and you know, I mean, I don't think they really suffered. And well, one just, I mean, Charles didn't allow people to come at night anymore. I mean, he felt that was really too much to interfere with the family life.
Yes,
too.
Did you find you had that at one time, that you were getting people come to you?
It was terrible to begin with. You see, and we had to watch out, so, because, you see, what the Nazis did, they were really very clever. With the flow of refugees, they stuck in some people as refugees who were to watch an eye on the refugees. there was a girl who was very attractive to look at, who always hung on to some of my Austrians, who I knew were doing things for the British war machine. And you see, Austrians can never keep their mouth shut. Germans can, but not Austrians. The girl was called Pick. And I suspected her from the very beginning. And everybody in the committee said I was an absolute idiot. Of course, she was perfectly all right. They had all her credentials. But I just didn't like her. Way. And when she came before the tribunal, when she, in the morning, when she, Mrs. Masterman, the wife of the liberal politician, did help us, and she always went as our representative to the tribunals. I went in the office and said, look, I'm sure that girl is a bad one. I'm quite sure. And they said, Greta, don't be idiotic. She's perfectly all right. And she was an A. They found the police knew more about her than me. And she was put into internment at once. And yet, you see, it was just that instinct.
That's interesting what you've said. Did you find generally the British police were well informed?
I think the British police were, the alien police were very knowledgeable. Very knowledgeable. That is, of course, what we found so extraordinary. When we had done all the paperwork about bringing people in, you know, clearing them, everything else, that they would know more about individuals than we would. As they did to Hans Schlossmann. When they told him, they knew Hans Schlossmann was absolutely reliable. When they told him he should not mix with certain people whom he had known in Germany.
And did it transpire that these people were unreliable?
Yes. This is what was so tremendously interesting.
Could I
and
ask?
And of course they put complete trust in us. I mean, I could go in there with a refugee and they would completely believe what I said. They would act on it. I mean, I very frequently had to go to the alien police with somebody or other, you see, or with a child who had to register because it became 16. But I mean, I always had the greatest courtesy. The only trouble was that forever after, when they ever found a foreign child, they rang me up, so the foreign child had nothing to do with me, meaning that I was the pump for all foreign children. But they were really, and they were kind. I mean, they were nice, which is very much to their credit. Mm.
Did you feel that they understood the situation? You know, the sort of situation the refugees...
I think the situation was so different from the 1418 war, where they were terribly unkind, where they took advantages of people. But there was never anything of that. In fact, the jingoism, you see, I was at school in England and then ultimately in college in England, but at that time I was still an Austrian subject. The London police took the attitude, you've married the mother of the children, so the children are British, you know. But when then somebody started to write letters to the police being just nasty. They had to take steps. And I really had a very unpleasant time in having to go to the police when I was up at Newnham. You know, they tried to take advantage of me and things like that. And people were so jingo, you know. I always remember, to my horror at school, that when I was being taught for communion, the vicar of the school vicar, I mean, we then didn't have a chapel of our own, we went to Harrogate Church, was terribly pro-German. He'd spent the time in Heidelberg and so on. And as soon as the war turned on, he became so jingo, so anti-German, so he'd had all this experience, that I was really quite, I mean, I was still a schoolgirl. I was absolutely shocked at this. But there was nothing of that sort of thing in the last war. I mean, this, I very much admired the sort of difference between the attitude, how people had grown in understanding between the First World War and the Second World War. And you found that in everything. I mean, we only, you know, met understanding and willingness to help and so on, which was, of course, very valuable.
Could I ask you, Mrs. Burkell, about the policy of internment? The policy of internment of the so-called enemy aliens. Could you tell me what sort of experience you had of it, perhaps starting off with the tribunals?
Well, of course, I can tell you quite a lot about this. Of course, in 1940, there was the great fear that the Germans would land in East Anglia. And they interned all the males, whether they were A, B, or C. And that, of course, was a terrible shock to the refugees, because they could only think of concentration camp. They didn't realize this was quite a different sort of thing. And of course, very soon, the people who obviously were refugees from Nazi persecution were let out. I mean, and they never felt any rancor against it. A lot of, now, anybody who was of military age and wasn't Jewish, but was a refugee, maybe for political reasons, was kept in internment. The terrible thing was that the interned, every boy and girl over the age of 16 who had not been before the tribunal. And that was, of course, a terrible tragedy. I mean, I had quite a number of boys at the Lees, for example. The Lees had been marvelously good. They had offered these three places to refugees, to sons of people who couldn't educate their children in Germany. But after that, they took a whole lot of my boys. They never refused a boy. And the purse took every girl. If she hadn't got a word of English, they would take her to school and let her sit through the classes. And within 6 weeks, those girls could talk English. And by the end of term, they were absolutely au courant with the work. And they did extremely well. But I couldn't get that out of the county school. They wouldn't take any child, excepting it had perfect English. And they wouldn't take any child under reduced fees. So, of course, we sent them all to the press, excepting ones who obviously were so stupid that they couldn't stand the racket of the press, because the press is a very academic school. But we had girls interned and boys interned who were 16 and just hadn't got before the tribunal, where they would all have been children, the category of protection. It had some very evil reaction on the girls who were sent to the Isle of Man with the A and B women prisoners. And that was, the influences were terribly bad. And I had a great deal of trouble with some of them afterwards. It was just the political influences, you see, and so on, and getting married to the wrong person, and, you know, and divorces, and oh, frightful trouble, sort of. And see, in the Isle of Man, the women were all A and B prisoners, excepting, of course, the young girls. And of course, these older women had a terrific influence on the girls until we could get the girls out. A lot of the boys were sent to Canada and to Australia. We did get them back. In fact, we got all our academic students back out of Canada and Australia. Not so much Australia. Australia allowed them to study. They let them free and allowed them to study, but they said it was too dangerous to take them out of the, to bring them back, you see, with a torpedo. But they did bring back our Cambridge academic students, and we got boys. Now, Shimali Mar's son was interned in Canada, and Canada was pretty tough internment. But they put the, they did one good thing. They put the 16-year-olds with, they put the 16-year-old with the people who they knew could be trusted, like the German clerics, the pastors, Hildebrand and people like that. But then, of course, they had a religious fervor in trying to turn all the Jewish boys into Christian boys. And I got Hans, now John, back with a Bible in his hand, wanting to become a Christian, to the great sorrow of his mother. But it wore off pretty quickly. But, but you know, that was a great calamity. Now, anybody who was interned after a bit of time could join the pioneers. And join, that meant joining the British Army. And a great many did join the pioneers. Others were too cowardly and preferred to sit in internment. But they ultimately all got out, and one put them into a trade or something. But it was a shock, because to them, they couldn't see the difference between internment in wartime and the concentration camp.
What do you yourself think of this policy of internment? Do you find any justification for it?
Well, you know, the strain in East Anglia was terribly great. I mean, there was this frightful feeling that the Germans would come any day. You see, I had pneumonia and pleurisy while all this was happening. And of course, nobody dared to tell me that it was happening. But when I had to go to the chest clinic, I found that there were roadblocks all over Cambridge. And I said, what's all this about? And so the truth came out. And then, of course, they wanted to send me away. And I said, how can I go away and leave my children here? perfectly out of the question. I'll go away if I can take my children, but I'm not going away. And so I had a great fight, and I managed to get the TB Medchap to see my point of view, persuade my doctor to let me take my children, and we went to Kapel Kürk. I wouldn't go away. You said I couldn't get well. And being a Red Cross lady, I had a Red Cross BAD nurse every night. And I just couldn't get well. Temperatures and so, sweats, whatever we did. Within a week in Kapel Kürk, different air, I was all right. So, it does prove, that you really have got to go away when you get very sick. And I was joined with Mrs. Guthrie and her children, and we had a marvelous time. The children all quarreled, and we put them to bed and had nice evenings reading our books. But of course, that was one of the really amusing occasions. Harry, big Harry, used to come on a bicycle to Kapel Kürk for the weekends.
Whereabouts is that, actually?
In Wales. And he had a sporting bicycle and had his maps in his hip pocket. And he was stopped by home guard and said, "You know, boy, you shouldn't be carrying those maps. You know, the Germans might come down any minute." And with Harry, of course, not realizing that Harry was originally German, was much amused on that occasion. But
did you have lots of messages from people who were interned asking for help?
As I say, this was so sweet of the governor of the camp ringing me up and telling me how all my pets were doing and what messages I was to give to their wives and so on. I felt that was very touching.
This was the Isle of Man, was it?
No, that was a camp in East Anglia. No, the Isle of Man, that was our school children. And of course we tried to get them out as quickly as possible. But you see, the real trouble about internment was, once the Home Office passed the children, or whoever it was, to the people who were responsible for internment, you dealt with the War Office. It had no more to do with the Home Office. And the War Office was much more difficult to persuade to let people out than the Home Office, who knew the real history.